dinner. I raise the wand and ting it, just a little. The door opens, revealing a Native American woman with a scarf wrapped around her head. "I'm sorry," I say, so surprised to not see Delia that I cannot find any words for a moment. "I must have the wrong address." But then, Sophie pokes her head out of what must be a closet. "Fitz!" she yells, and comes at me with the force of a natural disaster. "If I stand on Ruth Ann's toilet, I can touch all the walls in the bathroom at once. Wanna see?" The Indian woman frowns at Sophie. "I thought I hired you to work for me, not to go stand on toilets." Sophie beams. "Ruth Ann's paying me a dollar to glue the sequins on one-night stand Barbie's miniskirt." "One-night stand Barbie?" I repeat. "She's my featured item this month," Ruth Ann says. "Comes shrink-wrapped with Rohypnol Ken. For you, only $29.99 for the pair." She gestures to the small fold-out table in the center of the tiny room, covered with beads and glitter and plastic dismembered body parts, stacked like a mass grave. Sliding heavily into the bench seat, she pulls a pair of spectacles out by a cord that snakes into her shirt and starts assembling arms and legs and torsos into dolls. $9.99, she bargains. I take a $10 bill out of my pocket and slap it on the table. Ruth Ann slips the money into her jeans and hands over the dolls. "She's not here, you know."
"Who?"
She raises an eyebrow, and her fingers fly over a Barbie head, braiding the hair. I let my gaze roam the trailer, which is packed to the gills with dusty old appliances, heaps of vintage magazines, smashed toys, and bald or filthy or amputee Barbies. "I'm Fitz," I say, a belated introduction. "I'm busy," Ruth Ann replies.
"Ruth Ann sells stuff that other people throw away," Sophie says.
I have always wondered about the people who cruise the streets before the garbage trucks come, taking stained couches and broken bicycles from the rubbish piles. What some people cast off, I guess, other people would want to keep. Ruth Ann shrugs. "Some fools will buy anything made by an Indian. I could probably rearrange my own trash and say it's art, get myself a show at the Heard Museum."
"I went to the hospital today," Sophie says. "I was sick when I woke up, but Ruth Ann got rid of the feathers, and now I'm better."
I look at the old woman for explanation, but she just shakes her head. Whatever was wrong with Sophie must have passed. She's perfectly fine now.
"Where's your mom, Soph?"
I ask, but she shrugs. No one seems inclined to talk. I clear my throat and fiddle with an arm. It looks like it belongs to Ken. It has a biceps muscle. Ruth Ann tosses me a torso and a head. "Knock yourself out." I start to put together a Ken, stopping only once to notice the lack of genitalia, and wondering why I never knew that Ken was a eunuch. Probably because the only girl I'd ever played with was Delia, and she wouldn't have been caught dead with a doll in her possession. When the body is assembled, I pick up a Sharpie marker and begin to draw dotted lines and symbols down the torso and over the extremities. I label spots. Bad luck. Searing pain. Sexual dysfunction. Monetary ruin. Sophie cranes her chin over my arm.
"What are you making, Fitz?"
"Something for your mom. Voodoo Eric." Ruth Ann laughs, and when I look up, I see her measuring me differently. "You," she decides, "may turn out better than I thought." Just then the door opens, and I can see Delia tying Greta's leash to the arm of a large plaster garden gnome. "Stay," she instructs. When she walks inside and sees me, her face lights up. "Thank God you're here,"
Thank Southwest Airlines. They had more to do with it. Ruth Ann, Delia says, presenting me. This is my best friend in the world.
We've met.
Yes, Ruth Ann was kind enough to let me discover my inner artist. I lift the doll and give it to Delia. It might come in handy. Listen, do you think we could go somewhere and talk? I look around as I say this, but I can literally see the end of Ruth Ann's little trailer from where I'm standing. I can practically touch the end of Ruth Ann's little trailer from where I'm standing. Go on, Ruth Ann says, waving us away. Sophie and me, we're busy. But Delia leans over and feels Sophie's forehead with her lips, an act I've never understood. Do all mothers automatically have some kind of thermometer gauge in their mouths? She turns to me. This morning, I heard. I couldn't even reach Eric to have him meet us at the hospital.
I know, I reply. He told me he tried to call you on your cell.
Delia looks at me sharply. You saw Eric already? You went to the law office? I shift uncomfortably. I think about the notes I have in my back pocket, about the arraignment, the ones I will write up and send in an email to the New Hampshire Gazette. I ran into him in court. Your father was arraigned about an hour ago. Delia shakes her head. I don't understand. Eric would have called me. I don't think Eric knew your father was going to be arraigned. He nearly missed the whole proceeding. She wanders outside the trailer and sits down beside Greta in the shade. I got mad at him last night. Eric? My father. She draws up her knees, rests her cheek on them. I went to the jail to tell him I would testify or do whatever he needed me to do. I wanted to hear the truth. But when he started to tell it to me, all I could think about was how he lied. So I left. Delia glances up, near tears. I walked out on him. I rest my hand on her shoulder. I'm sure he knows how hard this is for you. What if he thinks that the reason I wasn't in court was because I hate him?
Do you?
Delia shakes her head. It's like math that doesn't add up, you know? I mean, on the one hand, there's my mother who's out there somewhere, which is amazing. And I can't ever get the time back with her that I lost. But on the other hand, I had the best childhood, even if it wasn't the one I started out with. My father literally gave up his life for me. And that's got to count pretty heavily. She sighs. You can love a person and still hate the decisions they've made, can't you? I stare at her for a moment longer than I should. I guess, I say. I still don't know why he did it, Delia murmurs. Then maybe you ought to try asking someone else. She turns to me. I was going to ask you about that, she says. I keep hitting dead ends. I didn't get a chance to ask my father for my mother's real maiden name when I was at the jail. I got too upset first. And I tried calling the City Hall Records Department and explaining, but they said that without it, they couldn't
give you this.
I reach into my back pocket and pull out a piece of paper. I watch Dee read the unfamiliar address and phone number. The first class in journalism school is how to charm a records clerk, I explain. Elise Vasquez? She reads. She remarried. I hand her my cell phone. Go ahead. Hope holds her frozen for a moment, and then Delia reaches for the phone. She punches in the Scottsdale area code before suddenly aborting the call. "What's the matter?" I ask. "Feel this," she says, and she takes my hand and holds it just north of her heart. It is racing, fluttering as fast as a hummingbird's flight, as fast as indecision, as fast as my own of her heart.
Part 3. Nothing stands out so conspicuously or remains so firmly fixed in the memory as something which you have blundered. Cicero. Delia. If you think motherhood is an instinct, you'd be wrong. In college, when I majored in zoology, I wrote my thesis on the way offspring can identify their mothers and vice versa. Instinct, as it turns out, isn't defined as a trait you're born with, but one that develops as a parent and child bond. There's that famous Conrad Lawrence study, the scientist who had goslings trailing after him because he allowed them to imprint on him when they hatched. I tracked hyenas and wild pigs and seals, all of whom used vocal clues and pheromones and physical resemblance to pick their mothers out of a crowd. Attentive mothers tended to be the ones with the most helpless babies, humans and chicks and mice. On the other hand, fish who could take care of themselves at birth were left behind immediately by their mothers. In this sense, parenthood became solely about defense. But every now and then I'd come across an anomaly, an instinct gone awry, like the cuckoo, which would invade another bird's nest, throw out the real eggs, and leave its own behind to be reared by a surrogate parent. Or the seal pups that were abandoned when food went scarce. Or Neanderthals who killed their young if the alternative was starvation. Sometimes, when conditions leave no other choice, parental instinct falls by the wayside. Years later, I read that someone had found genetic components to good motherhood. The MEST and the PEG3 genes occur on chromosome 19, and ironically, they only work if they're inherited from the father. Imprinting like this usually occurs in evolution because of a genetic battle of the sexes. It's in the best interests of the female to have more litters, but it's in the best interests of the male to protect the child that's already been born. The jury is still out on these findings, but I believe them. All I have to do is think of Sophie and how there are certain details I wish I could freeze in amber, her munchkin voice or her iridescent pink fingernails or the xylophone of her laughter. It's no great stretch of imagination to assume that my father was the one who passed this feeling on to me, who made me conscious of the things we want to keep. My mother's home is small and neat, afloat on a sea of white stones. There is a mailbox at the end of the driveway that says Vasquez. I stop in front of a saguaro that is at least 11 feet tall and has an arm lifted in a friendly wave. Ruth Ann says it takes 50 years for a saguaro to sprout a single arm. She says that their flowers are so bright and beautiful, they have been known to make sparrows weep. I run my hand over my hair again. After pinning it back and pulling it into a ponytail, I finally decided to leave it falling over my shoulders. Surely she'd remember brushing it when I was little. I'm wearing the nicest outfit I threw into my suitcase in our hasty escape, a dark blue dress that I had planned on wearing to court. I smooth the skirt down, wishing I could will away the wrinkles. I take deep breaths. How do you walk into someone's life again after 28 years? How do you pick up when you were too young to know where you left off? For courage, I try to reverse the roles. What if it was Sophie coming to see me after so long? I cannot imagine any circumstance where I wouldn't immediately feel a connection to her. And I have shared roughly the same short amount of time in Sophie's life that my mother shared with me. I wouldn't care if she was pierced, bald, rich, poor, married, gay, whatever, just as long as she was back. So why am I so worried about making a first impression? I answer my own question. Because you only get to do it once. Every time after, you are only making up for what happened during that initial meeting. I stand on the front step, wondering how I will ever get up the courage to knock, when the door swings open telekinetically. The woman exits backward. She's wearing faded jeans and an embroidered peasant blouse and looks much younger than I would have expected. "See, bread and refried beans," she calls out to someone still inside. "I heard you the first time." Then she steps out and plows right into me. "Disculpe me, I didn't see." Her hand comes up to cover her mouth. Her face looks like a photo of me that has been crumpled and then, on second thought, smoothed again. My features, but worn soft by the finest lines. Her hair is one shade blacker than mine. However, it is her smile that renders me speechless. Two eye teeth twisted just a quarter turn, the reason I spent 4 years in braces and a retainer. "Gracias a Dios," she murmurs. When she reaches out, I let her touch me, my shoulder and neck, and finally cupping my cheek. I close my eyes and think of all the times I had stroked my own arm in the dark, pretending to be her, failing because I couldn't surprise myself with comfort. "Beth," she says, and then she blushes. "But that's not your name anymore, is it?" In that moment, it is not important at all what she calls me, but it is critical what I call her. My voice breaks. "Are you my mother?" I don't know which one of us reaches for the other, but suddenly I am in her arms, a place that I had to imagine my entire life. Her hands run over my hair and my back as if she is trying to make sure I'm real. I try to narrow my mind to a sliver of recognition, but it's hard to know whether this feels familiar because I remember it or because I so badly want it to. She still smells like vanilla and apples. "Look at you," she says, holding me far enough away to stare at my face. "Look at how beautiful you are." In the background, someone speaks, a low baritone with a hint of an accent.
"Elise, who's there?"
He steps forward, a lean man with white hair, coffee-colored skin, and a mustache.
"Ella podría ser su gemelo," he whispers.
"Victor," my mother says, her voice so full it spills over. "You remember my daughter." I have no recollection of this man, but apparently he knew me.
"Hola,"
Victor says. He starts to reach for me, and then on second thought, slides his arm around my mother's waist instead. "I didn't know if it was all right to come here," I admit. "I didn't know if you wanted to see me." My mother squeezes my hand. "I've been waiting to see you for almost 30 years," she says. "As soon as they told me who you were now, I tried to call you, but no one answered." The relief her words send through me, the fact that she was trying, nearly buckles my knees. It wasn't that my mother hadn't called, it was that I hadn't answered, because I was flying to Arizona to be with my father while he stood trial. We are both thinking this, and it reminds us that this is not just any reunion. Victor clears his throat.
"Why don't you two sit down inside?"
Her house is decorated with bright Talavera pottery and wrought iron. As we walk into the living room, I look for clues that will tell me more. Toys that speak of other children or grandchildren, the titles of music CDs on the shelves, framed photos on the walls. One catches my eye. It is a snapshot of my mother and me wearing matching embroidered dresses. I'd seen a similar photo, maybe taken the minute before or after this one, in my father's secret stash.
"I'll get some iced tea,"
Victor says, and he leaves my mother and me alone. You would think, when there is so much to say, that it comes easily. But instead, we sit in an uncomfortable silence.
"I don't know where to start,"
my mother says finally. She looks down into her lap, suddenly shy.
"I don't even know what you do."
"Search and rescue. I work with a bloodhound and we look for missing people," I say. "It's crazy, given the circumstances."
"Or maybe it's because of them," my mother suggests.
She folds her hands in her lap and we look at each other for another moment.
"You live in New Hampshire?"
"Yes, my whole life," I say, before I realize that isn't true. Most of it, anyway. I dig in my pocket for the photo I've brought along of Sophie and pass it to her. "This is your granddaughter." She takes the picture from me and pores over it.
"A granddaughter,"
my mother repeats. "Sophie.
She looks like you."
"And Eric, my fiancé." I'd hoped that by seeing my mother, some floodgate would open and all the gaps in my mind would be filled with memory. I'd hoped that some reflex recollection would take over, so that when I heard her laugh or saw her smile or felt her touch, it would be familiar instead of new. But after that initial embrace, we've gone back to what we really are: two people who have just met. We can't rebuild our past because we haven't even leveled common ground. For years, I'd sketched my mother out in my mind by stealing bits and pieces of other people's lives. A woman who stood in the town pool coaxing her tiny daughter to jump off the side into her arms. A fairy tale character who died tragically young. Meryl Streep in Sophie's Choice. Any of those women I would have known in an instant. I would have been able to fall into easy conversation. Any of those women would have known what I have been doing all my life. In none of my imaginings was my mother Spanish-speaking or remarried or awkward. In none of my imaginings was she a total stranger. When your mother is made out of dreams, anything real is bound to disappoint you.
"When is the wedding?"
she asks politely. "September." At least that was when it was supposed to be. I expected my father to give me away before I learned he might be going to prison for not being able to do that in the first place.
"Victor and I are celebrating our silver anniversary this year," my mother says.
"Did you have children?"
She shakes her head. "I wasn't able to."
My mother looks down at her hands.
"Your father, did he remarry?"
"No." She lifts her gaze to mine.
"How is Charles?"
It is strange to hear him referred to by that other name. "He's in jail," I say bluntly.
"I never asked for that. I'm not going to lie. There was a time I was so angry at him for taking you, I would have willingly sent him to prison for life. But it's been so long. The only thing I cared about when the prosecutor called to tell me they'd found him was you."
I picture her standing in the driveway of this house, even though I know it isn't where I grew up. I imagine her expression at the moment she realizes I'm not coming back. I see her face, but it has all of my own features. My mother looks at me hard. Do you remember anything, she asks, from before? Sometimes I have dreams, I say. There's one about a lemon tree, and one where I come into a kitchen with broken glass all over it. My mother nods. You were three, she says. That wasn't a dream. It is the first time someone has been able to confirm a memory that I couldn't make sense of, and I feel my arms and legs go weak. Your father and I, we had a fight that night, my mother says. We woke you up. Was I the reason you got divorced?
You?
She seems surprised. You were the best part of our marriage. The question now is burning a path up my throat. The words come out like fire. Is that why he took me? Just then, Victor enters the living room carrying a tray. There is a pitcher of iced tea and cookies the size of a baby's palm covered in powdered sugar. Under his arm is a shoebox.
I thought you might want these too, he says, and he hands it to her.
She is embarrassed by it. I thought it might not be the right time, she tells him.
Why don't you let Bethany decide that?
It's just some things I kept, my mother explains, pulling the rubber band free. I knew that one day I'd find you, but somehow I always expected you to still be 4 years old. There is a lacy christening cap and the placard from the hospital bassinet with my name, my other name, written by a nurse in red ink, along with my weight, 6 pounds, 6 ounces. A tiny china teacup with a chip in the handle, a square of paper with the carefully printed pencil letters of a child, I LVU. Proof that once I did. The only other item in the box is a miniature patchwork quilt made of triangles of red silk and orange shag and paisley print and sheer voile. My mother shakes this out over her lap. I made this for you when you were a baby, out of every bit of comfort I could find. She touches the red silk. This came from a slip that once was my grandmother's. The orange was the throw rug from your father's dorm room, the paisley a maternity dress of mine, and the voile, that came from my wedding veil. You ate with it and slept with it, and I had to force you not to bathe with it. You used to hide underneath it when you were afraid, like you thought it might make you disappear. I had forgotten my blanket. I want to go home, I told him. We can't, he said, but he didn't tell me why. I remember, I say softly. I am 4 again, reaching up as she lifts me out of the bath, holding tight to cross a street, clutching this blanket with my fist. In a half hour, my mother has managed to give me what my father couldn't, my past. I reach across my mother's lap to touch the blanket, wishing it still had the same magic powers that it used to, that I might press it to my cheek and rub the corner of it against my eyelids and know that everything is going to be all right by the time the sun comes up. Mommy, I say, because that is what I used to call her. I may not know my mother yet, but we have this much in common. Neither of us, it turns out, has been the only one who lost someone she loved. It is strange suddenly having a memory come back out of nowhere. You think you're going crazy. You wonder where this recollection has been hiding all your life. You try to push it away because you think you've hammered out the whole timeline of your life. But then you see that one extra moment, and suddenly you are breaking apart what you thought was a solid segment and seeing it for what it is. Just a string of events, shoulder to shoulder, and a gap where there is room for one more. There is so much I want to ask her. There are still so many questions. When I get back to the trailer, Fitz is fanning himself with a phone book and Sophie is asleep on the couch. "How did it go?" he asks. I have been thinking about what I should tell him, and Eric for that matter. It's not that I have anything to hide, but there's something about talking about the fragile bridge my mother and I just built that in some way would diminish it. "She wasn't who I wanted her to be," I say carefully. "But that didn't turn out as bad as I expected."
"What's she like?"
"She's younger than my father, and she's Mexican," I tell him. "She grew up there." Fitz laughs.
"And to think you failed Spanish."
"Shut up."
"Was she happy to see you?"
"Yes." He smiles a little.
"And are you happy you saw her?"
It's weird, not knowing anything about my own mother. But in a way, it's okay because she doesn't really know anything about me. With my father, it was all imbalanced. He knew everything and he kept it a secret. "Grandpa tells me his secrets," Sophie says, and we both look over toward the couch. She's sitting up now, her face still rosy with sleep. "Is he here yet?" I sink down beside her and haul her onto my lap. There are so many times that I've been seized with a need to hold Sophie. After a particularly sappy movie, after a near-miss car accident in an ice storm, when I'm watching her sleep. What would it be like to have someone take that right away from me? "What secrets does Grandpa tell you?" I ask. "That he bought the cheap grapes at the supermarket, even though he told you they were the organic ones, and that he's the one who put your white shirt in the washing machine and turned it pink." She turns to me. "I don't know if Grandpa's going to fit in this house with the rest of us." I look at Fitz. "Grandpa isn't going to be staying with us," I tell Sophie. "You know how the police came to the house the other day? You said they were playing a game." "Well, it turns out that they weren't, Soph. Grandpa made a big mistake, one that hurt a lot of people. And because of that, he has to go. He's going to stay." I try, but I cannot summon up the words. Fitz kneels in front of us.
"You know how you got a timeout when you threw the tennis ball in the living room and broke the window?"
Sophie nods.
"Your grandfather has to live for a while in a place where grown-ups go when they get timeouts."
Sophie looks at me. "Did he break a window?" "No, I think, just my heart."
"He broke the law," Fitz says. "So for now, he has to stay in jail until a judge says he can leave."
Sophie considers this. "Bad guys go to jail. They wear handcuffs." "He's not wearing handcuffs, and he's not a bad guy," I tell her.
"What did he do?"
"He took a little girl away from home," I say. "Didn't her mother tell her not to talk to strangers?" How do I tell Sophie that sometimes it's not strangers that prey on us? It's those we love who can do the most harm. "It happened a long time ago," I explain, "and I was the little girl."
"But he was still your daddy, right?"
Sophie shakes her head. Daddies are allowed to take you places. Not this time. I feel my throat close like a fist. I didn't get to see my mother, not for lots of years, and I really missed her. Why didn't you just tell him you wanted to go home? It is too complicated to explain it all to Sophie, that there were lies involved and aliases, that people you love don't usually come back from the dead, that I couldn't tell my father I wanted to go home because I didn't know I was missing. But now I do.
This ends Disc 5, Vanishing Acts, Disc 6.
On the drive back to the Madison Street Jail, I wonder if Sophie will remember this trip to Phoenix when she gets older. I wonder if she'll be able to picture the short spikes of a prickly pear, like stubble on a woman's leg. If she'll know her grandmother. If she'll have any memory of her grandfather before he was imprisoned. The truth is, she won't have to. That is my job. What is a parent, really, but somebody who picks up the things a child leaves behind? A trail made of stripped-off clothing, orphaned shoes, tiny bright plastic game pieces, and nostalgia. And who hands back each of these when it's needed? What is a parent but someone you trust to keep you safe and to tell you the truth? I am pacing the small cubicle when my father is brought in to see me. I can't look him in the eye, so I focus instead on the cut on his face, a fishhook that curves down the side of his cheek. I pick up the phone to talk to him. "Who hurt you?" I ask, swallowing.
"It'll be all right."
He touches his face gingerly.
"I didn't think you'd be coming back so soon."
"I didn't think I would either," I say. "I'm sorry I missed your arraignment." My father shrugs.
"Plenty more where that came from," he says. "Is it true, what Eric said? That you wanted me to plead not guilty?"
"I love you," I say, my eyes filling with tears. "I want you to do whatever it takes to get out of there." He leans closer to the glass between us.
"That's exactly why I had to run away with you, Dee."
See, I could almost believe that. Except, I went to see my mother today. I watch his face go white.
"How is she?"
"Well, she's practically a stranger," I say. He splays his hand on the glass.
"Delia,
don't you mean Bethany?" Shock squeezes through the telephone connection between us. A static silence.
"Did you really have that bad a life?" my father asks tightly.
"I don't know. I have no idea what it would have been like if I'd been brought up by my mother." When he doesn't answer, I keep talking. "Did you know she saved my baby blanket? The one with all the patches? The one that I wanted to go back for the day we left, but you wouldn't let me? Did you know that she still celebrates my real birthday? I didn't even do that growing up." My father sinks down heavily onto the stool in the booth. "Maybe you can tell me what I'm missing," I say, my voice too high and thin. "Because the woman I spoke to was just as sorry as I was for having missed 28 years.
"I'll bet she's sorry,"
my father says, so quietly that I think I've misheard him. "What did she do to you?" I whisper. "What did she do that made you so angry that you had to get revenge by kidnapping me?"
"It wasn't what she did to me," my father answers. "It's what she did to you."
A vein starts to throb in his temple.
We did go back for your blanket, he says. We walked into the house, and you tripped over your mother, who was lying on the floor, passed out cold. And I can tell you exactly what your life would have been like if she was the one who brought you up. You would have had to make yourself breakfast before kindergarten because your mother was too hungover to do it for you. You would have had to check the toilet tank to throw out the vodka bottle that was hidden inside. You would have wondered why she couldn't love you enough to want to stop. Your mother was a drunk, Delia. She couldn't take care of herself, much less a baby. That's the wonderful upbringing I took you away from. That's the truth I lied about. That's what I wanted you to miss. I stumble backward, the telephone line stretching like an umbilicus. I have learned this lesson over and over doing search and rescue work. If you choose to go looking for something, you'd better be ready for whatever it is you find, because it may not be what you've been expecting. I gave you the mother you didn't get, my father pleads. If I'd told you the truth, if I told you what she was really like, wouldn't that have been worse than the way you lost her the first time? For nearly a year after I was told about my mother's death, I would run to the door every time the doorbell rang. I was certain that my father had gotten it wrong, that any moment my mother was going to show up so that we could live happily ever after. But she hadn't. Not because she was dead, as my father had told me, but because she had never existed. I let the telephone receiver drop from my hand and turn around away from the plexiglass. I don't look back at my father, not even when he starts screaming both of my names and a guard comes to take him away. I have never been a very good drunk. Even when I was a student at UNH, a few beers would make me sick and hard liquor only made me hyper-aware. Prone to wondering why the tables had been stained the color of hazelnuts and whether anyone ever bothered to clean the flies out of the ceiling fan in the ladies' bathroom. I didn't know for a long time that Eric was an alcoholic. When Eric drank, he only became more engaging and funny and amusing. He did it so seamlessly, in fact, that it took me several years to understand that the reason Eric always seemed to be the same person, whether he had a beer in his hand or not, was not because he didn't get drunk, but because he was hardly ever sober. The life of the party who can build geometric carbon models out of toothpicks and maraschino cherries and get a whole bar full of Japanese tourists to join in singing Yellow Submarine becomes less charming when that same person forgets he is supposed to pick you up after work and lies about where he has been all night and cannot hold a conversation in the morning unless he's had some hair of the dog that bit him. I've hesitated this long to accept his marriage proposal because I didn't want my child to grow up with a parent who is unreliable and selfish. So how can I blame my own father for feeling the same way? When I pull into my mother's driveway again, I am so upset that I am shaking. My mother comes to the door, mixing something in a mortar and pestle. It smells like rosemary. Her face lights up when she sees me. Come on in. Is it true? Is what true? That you're an alcoholic. The smile dries on my mother's face, paint peeling. She glances around the street to see who might have heard and ushers me inside. There is a part of me dying to be told that this, like so many other things, is just another fabrication of my father's. This is another step in his scheme to make me hate my mother too. But she pushes her hair back from her face, tucks it behind her ears. Yes, she says bravely. I am. She folds her arms across her chest. And I haven't had a drink in 26 years.
an honest confession can slice the hardest heart in two. Why didn't you tell me?
You didn't ask, my mother says quietly. But it is a lie, even if you don't say it. It is a lie when you force a connection because you so desperately want there to be one. It is a lie when you tell yourself that you will have lunches together and pass down secret recipes and do all the 100 other things that I have fantasized daughters do with their mothers, as if that might actually make us any less foreign to each other. No one gets to start where they left off. It just doesn't work that way. She reaches for me, and when I back away, her eyes fill with tears. You came here, and you were so happy to see me, she says. I thought if I told you, I'd lose you all over again. You let me think you were a victim, I accuse. I was, my mother says. I may not have been a perfect mother, but I was your mother, Beth, and I loved you. Past tense. That isn't my name, I say tightly. And this time, it is my decision to leave. Greta and I were once called during a blizzard to find a teenage girl who had left a suicide note and disappeared, leaving her single father in an absolute state of panic. It was down in Meredith, the Lakes region. The local police had begun to search on a footprint trail, but the snow was falling so fast that her tracks vanished almost the moment they were located. Locals had been warned off the roads that night. The only vehicles I passed on my way there were plows and sanding trucks. When I arrived, I was taken to the girl's father. He was rocking back and forth in an armchair, fist pressed to his mouth as if he were afraid of the grief that might spill out. Mr. D'Amato, I asked, does Maria have a special place? A spot she goes to when she wants to be alone? He shook his head. Nowhere I know. Can you show me her room? He led me to the back of the house. The girl's room was typical. Twin bed, milk crate bookshelves, laptop, lava lamp. But unlike most teenagers' bedrooms, this one was spotless. The bed had been made, the papers cleared from the top of the desk, the clothes were all neatly hanging in the closet, the trash can had been dumped. Because Maria D'Amato had already done her wash, too, I scented Greta off a pair of shoes I found in her closet. Outside, the snow whistled and spun around us. Greta started out west toward the road and then veered into the woods. At points, she had to leap snowdrifts. At other times, I fell on my hands and knees in them. Every time I opened my mouth, I tasted ice. 2 hours later, Greta broke through the trees and began to tiptoe across the frozen flat of the lake. With all this snow, it did not look like a body of water, but instead a wide-open field. Snowflakes the size of quarters clotted on my lashes and lips and gave Greta Groucho Marx eyebrows. The powder made the ice even more hazardous. We both went sprawling a few times. But finally, Greta stopped and put her front paws on a mound that didn't sink. She turned a small circle, did it again. I saw the girl's hair first, frozen into jagged spikes. I rolled her over and immediately began to do artificial respiration, but she came up scratching like a cat. "Get off me! Get off me!" she shrieked. And then she opened her eyes and started to sob. The EMT workers who met us at the lake said that the snow had acted as an insulator, keeping Maria alive longer than she might have been otherwise. Her father, who had been called with the good news, was waiting at the front door when we returned. Holding my arm for support, Maria took a tentative step toward her father. Suddenly, Greta stepped between them and growled low in her throat. "Greta," I said, calling the dog off.
but in that instant, I'd felt Maria relax, as if she'd been vindicated. Believe me, I have seen it all, from delicate boys with the faces of sprites who run away from the teasing of bullies, to teens who climb to the top of water towers intent on dying closer to heaven, to the willow-thin girls who hide in the night from their mother's boyfriends. My job, though, is to bring them home, not to judge the motives that made them run away. So that night, I returned Maria D'Amata to the custody of her grateful parent. I did what I was expected to do. A month later, the detective on the case called to tell me that Maria had shot her father and then killed herself. I gave Greta an extra serving of dog chow that day for understanding more than any human had. It just goes to show you, sometimes knowing what's right isn't a rational decision or even what works on paper. Sometimes leaving is the best course of action after all. When Sophie was 2, Eric and I took her fishing. It was a lazy Sunday, and we were sitting on a dock on Goose Pond. Eric would thread a worm onto the hook and cast, then cup his hands around Sophie's on the fishing rod. She had just learned the word fish, and when we pulled a trout or a bass out of the water, she'd clap her hands and say it over and over. To this day, I'm not sure how it happened. Eric had let go of Sophie to bait the hook, and I was pointing to the rainbow scales of the trout that we'd just released back into the cool, dark water. There was the tiniest splash, like a rock being skipped across the surface of the pond, and we both looked up to see that Sophie was gone. She wasn't wearing a life jacket. She fought us like crazy when we tried to zip it up, and we'd rationalized with ourselves. With both of us watching her, what could go wrong? "Sophie?" Eric yelled, the ragged edge of panic serrating her name. I didn't think, just jumped into the water fully clothed and opened my eyes. It was cloudy, and my shoes kicked up sand from the bottom, but there was a flash of something bright, and I lunged for it. Sophie, who didn't know how to swim, had sunk like a stone and was drifting underneath the dock. I grabbed her by her shirt, yanked her over my head, handed her to Eric. He laid her out on the rough, weathered boards while she sputtered and choked, and I hauled myself out of the pond. She was too frightened to cry, and although it felt like a lifetime, the whole episode had lasted less than 2 minutes. The bright spot I'd seen under the water was a necklace my father had given her for her birthday, a silver star to wish on. Sophie likes to hear the story of how we saved her life. She can repeat all the details, but they are trappings of a story we've seasoned to perfection over the years. She has no recollection of the incident firsthand, and Eric and I are both grateful for that. There are some things, I think, you're better off not remembering. The back of the trailer park wedges wide into a dry, dusty vista, which is where Eric takes me to see the sunset, a fuchsia curtain being drawn down through the pleats of the mountains. He's still dressed in a suit, but he's loosened his tie. We watch the sky turn every watercolor shade of orange and purple, a painting too lovely to be real, while a few feet away, Sophie throws a tennis ball for Greta to chase.
"I've been thinking that if law doesn't pan out for me, I'm going to audition as a Phoenix weatherman. Look, I've got it down. Monday, 104 and sunny. Tuesday, 104 and sunny. Wednesday, a cool 102 and..." "Eric," I say, "stop." He does, immediately. "I was only trying to cheer you up, Dee. Fitz tells me you had a hell of a day."
"You shouldn't have let me miss the arraignment," I reply.
"It wasn't my fault. They never even told me it was scheduled."
He slides an arm around my waist.
"Tell me about your mother."
I watch a hawk spiral overhead, his talons ripping the fabric of the sky to show a star or two. The sunset reaches its death throes, an explosion of ginger and pink and night. She's an alcoholic, I say finally. I can tell by the way he goes perfectly still that this is news for him.
Back then, too, he asks.
Yeah. I face him. Do you think that's why I fell in love with you?
God, I hope not, Eric laughs.
I'm serious. What if there was a part of me that couldn't fix her, so I had to fix you? Eric reaches for my shoulders.
You couldn't even remember her, Dee.
There is no denying this. But was it because I couldn't, or because I didn't want to? Memory isn't something that stays with you at all times. It's a quantity that gets summoned, or evoked, or brought to mind. It gets carried to an arena for our viewing pleasure. By definition, then, there are times it must go missing. Or does it? When I used to complain about Eric's drinking, he told me I was being unreasonable. One beer and I couldn't stand the smell on his breath. Now I wonder if this was some scent recollection, some unconscious understanding that a person who smelled of alcohol was bound to disappoint me. I went to the jail today, too, I say.
How'd that go?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I look up at him. -4.
Well, maybe this day wasn't an entire wash. You might have found me an affirmative defense.
What do you mean?
If your father had a valid reason to take you, like that your mother's drinking put you at risk, and he tried to get legal recourse but couldn't, it might get him off the hook.
Do you think it'll work?
It's better than the defense I was planning on running, Eric says.
Which was?
You were actually abducted by Miss Scarlet in the library with the wrench.
I shake my head, but he's managed to make me smile. When I think about my father, an ache rises like dough under my breastbone. I have not been fair to him. If anything, I'm guilty of the same offense, trying to keep the life we had from being ruined. Is it a crime when you love someone so much that you can't stand the thought of them changing? Is it a crime when you love someone so much that you can't see clearly? Beside me, Eric throws Greta's tennis ball far over the scrub of the land. In the coming dark, his features are blurred. He could be anyone, and so could I.
Elise. You probably don't remember this, but I once told you the story of the minute my mother died. I was 16, and miles away at the time. She was visiting her sister in Texas. But I woke up with a start at midnight to find her sitting on the edge of my bed with her hand touching my face. "Mommy?" I whispered. And she disappeared, leaving behind a scent of tuberose so strong that in all the years since, I have never been able to scrub it from my own skin. The next morning, my aunt called to tearfully tell me about the car accident, which happened at the exact moment I had awakened the night before. When I told her about my mother's visit, it was no surprise to either of us. Ask any faithful Mexican, and they will tell you what the brujas know. The dead come back to collect their footsteps. Over the years, Sometimes. I thought I could feel you standing behind me. I was certain that I could feel the paintbrush tickle of your hand on the canvas of my palm. I would start to run the water in the bathtub and hear you laughing from the other side of the door. Each of these times I pretended it hadn't happened. I'd close my eyes more tightly, or increase the flow of the faucet, or turn up the radio. I didn't let myself admit that the only way I might see you again was in that last moment when you would be back to gather your footsteps like an armful of brilliant desert flowers, a consolation prize you would present to me in return for losing you forever. On December 9th, 1531, the Blessed Virgin Mary appeared to an Indian named Juan Diego. A carpet of roses blossoming in the dead of winter and a Madonna with a coffee-colored face appearing on Juan Diego's robe were enough further evidence to convince the local